when you started doing so.
So,
recording is starting a couple of minutes into the class, my mistake. And so Marshall says, just add those numbers up. And if the result of the change is that the summed benefits to those who gain is larger than the summed loss to those who lose, that we'll call a gain. And if it's the other way around, we'll call that a loss. And we will call this criterion, Marshall didn't use the term, but we do, efficiency. And we'll say, therefore, a legal system, if going from one legal system to another results in net gains, we call the second one more efficient. And if we've got a legal system which is as efficient as it can be, if there are no further changes that result in net gains, we call that an efficient legal system. So Posner's conjecture in a strong form would be that the common law rules are the ones that maximize total benefits to everybody, summed over everybody in that sense. And it's worth emphasizing the point that the question is not how many dollars do you get, because dollars aren't the main thing we value, right? We value life and food and housing and so forth. And if somebody sells me a fine dinner, I end up with fewer dollars than before, but I'm still better off by the transaction. So the question is not adding up dollars in people's pockets, it's rather using dollars as our measure of value to people of outcomes. Right? Is that argument reasonably clear? Fine. All right. There are then some obvious problems with this definition of how well-off a society is. The first one is that it accepts individual evaluations of value. It assumes that the desire of heroin addicts for heroin counts, the desire of consumers of pornography for pornography counts, the desire of muggers to beat people up counts, that all individual values as expressed in human action count on the same scale. Second, because it's only counting the kind of values that are values to human beings that affect human action, we aren't considering the possibility that perhaps there are things that are valuable independent of humans, that maybe we ought to care about Mother Earth but don't, or maybe it is important that trees exist, or maybe God wants us to live in one style and not another. All of those things are really getting left out. This is a human-centered definition of value. And finally, and probably the most the criticism that bothers people most, it evaluates dollars as if they're of the same value to everybody. But in some sort of imprecise sense, we have a feeling that the happiness a poor person gets from $100 is probably a lot more than the happiness a rich person gets from $100, and that for that reason and for others, there may be not just poor and rich, but some people may really care about material things and want money, and other people may say, I don't care, as long as I've got enough to eat, I'm happy. So for a variety of reasons, a dollar to one person isn't really the same as a dollar to another. And what's the defense? How do we answer these criticisms? First, that while value to me may not be perfectly measured by my actions, maybe somehow I've got it wrong, it's the best measure we usually have available. That if we're running a system for a human society, such as the legal system, all we've got available to run that system are humans. There aren't any trees that are voting and suing and stuff like that. If God cares about things, he presumably has the resources to rearrange them as he wishes, and that we therefore are going to limit ourselves to human values. Marshall argues that for most of the issues you're concerned with, the variation among people in how much money matters probably averages out, that when you change the law, you help some rich people and some poor people, you hurt some rich people and some poor people. Different arguments some people have made is, well, maybe I'll be worse off by this change, but if we follow a general policy of making any change that produces net benefits, sometimes I'll win, sometimes I'll lose, probably on average I'll end up as a winner. Don't know that for sure, but seems reasonable. And a final argument that other people have made is that even if you're in favor of income redistribution because you want to transfer money from rich people who don't value it much to poor people who do, you could do that at a lower cost by just having taxes and spending, taxes and transfers, rather than by trying to bias the legal system in favor of poor people and against rich people. And you can go into those arguments if you are interested. Basically, I just wanted to sort of sketch what seemed to me the concept of efficiency we're using, the legitimate criticisms of it, and the plausible, to me, responses to those criticisms. Before we go on, any questions or any suggestions for a better criterion? All right, so the question is, if we want an efficient outcome, how do we get it? And the first approximation is a system of private property and trade, a system of laissez-faire. And the basic logic of that system is that everything anyone cares about belongs to somebody, and that if you own something, you're free to transfer it to anybody else who wants it on any mutually acceptable terms. So if we just think about the existing stuff and forget about production, what's going to happen? Anything I have is going to end up in the hands of whoever values it most, because whoever values it most will be willing to make me an offer I'm willing to accept. So if I've got an apple that's worth 50 cents to me and a dollar to you, after a bit you've got the apple and I've got an extra 50 cents to a dollar and you've paid 50 cents to a dollar. And if I sell the apple first to her because she values it at 70 cents, she sells it to you. So it's a fairly simple mechanism, but a pretty powerful one for rearranging property ownership in whatever way produces the maximum net benefits. Second step is, what about making stuff? The rule is that new stuff belongs to the people who made it. And if new stuff is made by a group of people, then the group are functioning under some agreement about how they divide it up, such as a firm or a partnership or anything of that sort. And now what happens is, if the value to me is greater than the value of the inputs required to make it, I'll make it and get it, because I'm getting a net benefit. If the value to you of something I could make is greater than the value of all the inputs I need to make it, then I'll make it and sell it to you. So the conclusion, to the first approximation at least, is that everything worth being made gets made, and everything ends up in the hands of the person who values it most. That's the basic, very, very simple logic. And the second approximation, which is really what the course is about, is how you design the legal system to deal with ways in which the first approximation breaks down. The economists sometimes put it in terms of an efficiency theorem, which can be put and proved in various forms. And the efficiency theorem, actually it occurs to me that I had a very slightly revised version of these PowerPoints that I was going to use and have on my flash drive, but had not gotten around to transferring to the computer because I wasn't thinking about it, and that at this point I happen to remember that I did that a little bit differently. So I am about to switch us from the hard drive version to the PowerPoint version, which will only take a couple of seconds due to the marvels of modern technology. And now let me zip through to here. So price equals, in a perfect competitive market, which some of you have studied in economics and which is clearly only an approximate picture of the world, price equals marginal cost equals marginal value. I will assume that even if you've taken economics, it may not have been yesterday. What does marginal cost mean? It means the cost of producing one more unit. So if we say General Motors could produce 1 million automobiles or 1,000,001 automobile, and the extra cost of making it 1,000,001 is $10,000, we then say the marginal cost of an automobile produced by General Motors is $10,000. What's marginal value? Marginal value is the value to a consumer of getting one more unit. So if I say, well, I don't have a car at the moment, I'd pay up to $15,000 to have a car, then the value to me is $15,000. If I have a car and I say, yeah, but I'd like to have a second car because my car is a little sports car and we occasionally take long trips with lots of stuff, the value to me of a second car is $9,000, then the marginal value of that is $9,000. And the basic logic of price equals marginal cost equals marginal value is that if cars sell for, let us say, $10,000, then manufacturers, as long as anybody can produce a car for less than $10,000 extra cost, you'll produce it and sell it and make some money, and they'll keep increasing the output until they, in one way or another, increase the cost, maybe by bidding up the wages of auto workers or the cost of steel or some other limited resource, until the next automobile they make costs them $10,000 to make. At that point, there's no reason to make any more automobiles. Right. So the basic argument is that producers will keep producing up to the point where their marginal cost is the price. As they do so, price might change, of course. As they produce more, that's going to drive down the price. But the stopping point is the one where price equals marginal cost. Does that make sense to people or not? When people are sort of say nothing, I can't tell if it's because they learned all this in kindergarten or because they're completely lost. It's useful to know this. I think it was my advisor when I was a PhD candidate in physics who referred to calculus as what we all learn in elementary school. So that gives you price equals marginal cost. The flip side of that is that you're a consumer, and if you can buy something at a price, well, if, let's think not of automobiles, which are very lumpy goods, but of tomatoes or apples or something, and I say, well, look, if I don't have any apples at all, I'd pay $2 for an apple. I really like apples. But the more apples a week I'm consuming, the less I want one more. At some point you get sick of apples, value might drop to zero. If I can get all the apples I want at 50 cents a piece, I will keep increasing the number I consume until one more apple is worth just 50 cents. Until that point, I'm gaining by having one more apple. Everybody does that, so therefore price equals both marginal cost and marginal value. And this is, in a sense, trivial, but it was really the resolution after a century or so of a puzzle that economists have been wrestling with of whether prices are determined by production costs or by usefulness to the consumer. And Marshall's answer was, that's like asking which blade of the scissors cuts the paper. That, in fact, it is the quantity goes to that quantity at which marginal value and marginal cost are the same, which will then be the price. That's the basic logic. Why does all of that matter? It matters because it gives us the slightly fancier version of the argument I made on the previous slide of why you get an efficient outcome out of laissez-faire, at least in simple, perfectly competitive worlds. Because what does that tell us? It tells us that producers are producing up to the point where producing one more unit would be worth just as much as it would cost them just as much to produce as it's worth to the consumer. That means that everything worth producing is getting produced and nothing more. It also tells us that the firms are producing their goods in the least costly way, where least costly doesn't just mean dollar cost to the firm, it also means human cost to everybody involved in the process. Because what's happening is that the dollar costs to the firm are a price. That price is somebody else's marginal cost, somebody else's marginal value. So if the way we produce applesauce is to bid apples away from consumers, the cost to the consumers of not having those apples is the marginal value they're giving up, which is the price of apples, which is what we pay. If the way we produce applesauce is to induce the orchards to produce more apples, the price we're paying is the marginal cost of producing another apple, which was the cost to the orchard of producing an extra apple. So if you run the system through, the critical point that non-economists never get is that the money prices aren't simply, you know, numbers or pieces of green paper. They are a signal of real costs out there to human beings. And so that tells us that everything is produced in the least costly way, because the firm says we could produce this good using a little more labor and a little less steel. Does that save money? That ultimately is asking, is the value to the worker of his leisure that we are saving if we use more steel more than the value to all the people involved in producing the steel of what they had to do to produce extra steel? So it's really quite an interesting and powerful result, which tells us that to some approximation, this enormously complicated calculation of how do we coordinate all of our activities is being done in a decentralized way by prices on the market. However, the real world is not a textbook price theory perfect competition, and it can deviate in a bunch of different ways that we will be looking at. One of them is monopoly. One of them is that when I said that a firm would produce an extra unit as long as the cost of producing it was less than what it could sell it for, that wouldn't be true if we're the only firm, and if we produce the extra unit, that's going to drive the price down a little, because the result will be that we'll be making less on all the units we're producing. So if we're trying to decide, do we produce 1 million cars a year or 1,001,000 cars a year, if we're the only car manufacturer and we say, well, we produce 1,001,000 car a year, we'll only sell the cars for $9,990, not for $10,000. That'll drive the price down. That's going to cost us $10, not just on the last car, but on every car. So in that case, it pays the monopolist to restrict output in order to hold the price above its cost. That's one out of many examples where imperfect competition means that the argument breaks down. There are other places it breaks down having to do with uncertainty and information costs. We'll be getting to that later, but you can think of a case where you say, you've got a car, the car is, it's a used car, the car is worth $10,000 to you and $12,000 to me. The problem is that I don't know it's worth $12,000 to me. Why don't I know that? Because I'm afraid the car might be a lemon. It might be, for all I know, that the reason you're selling it is that it spent more time in the repair shop than on the road. And I ask you, but of course you'll lie to me because you want to sell the car to me. So, and it might be that I've got no inexpensive way of finding out if it's a lemon. So even though it's worth $12,000 to me and $10,000 to you, I don't buy the car. That would be one example where we don't get the efficient outcome due to some problems having to do with information costs. Another set of problems come from the fact that not all transactions are voluntary. So that if one of the costs of producing that car was pumping a bunch of sulfur dioxide into the air from the steel mills that made the steel for the car, that imposed a cost on people living downwind, but the steel mill didn't have to pay them for that. The auto company didn't have to pay them for that. The consumers of autos didn't have to pay them for that. So therefore, the price the auto is selling for is, let us say, $200 below the real cost of producing it, and I will buy the car even if it's worth a little less to me than the real cost, including the cost of the pollution. That's one example of an involuntary transaction. Crime is another example. One of the reasons the world isn't perfect is he'll go around stealing stuff. And torts give you another case where people's actions don't involve, if I want something that's yours, I've got to pay you its value to get it. And then you can think about just transaction costs. That when I said that the apple would move from me to whom it's worth 50 cents to you to whom it's worth 70 cents to you to whom it's worth a dollar, all of you believed me. But of course the truth is that for him to find out that that apple is in her hands and that she's only worth, only valued at 70 cents, so it's worth his discussing with her the question of buying it, is going to cost him 50 cents worth of time and effort. So he's never going to bother to do it, so the apple stays with her. All right, that's transaction cost. Or to take my favorite example, which I use in various contexts, imagine that we have a system where everybody has an injunctive right against carbon dioxide pollution. Suppose we believe that global warming is a serious problem, that when anybody produces carbon dioxide, the result is to increase the chance that Bangladesh will flood 50 years from now, because more carbon dioxide means more global warming, means slightly higher sea levels, and Bangladesh has got lots of very low-lying coast. Does that mean that anybody in Bangladesh can forbid anyone in the world from releasing carbon dioxide? Well, according to what I've said so far, that's fine. It's not a problem, because after all, if the right to exhale is worth more to me than my exhaling costs you, I will pay you a millionth of a cent for the right to breathe. And you will accept a millionth of a cent each from a whole lot of people as a legitimate, sufficient compensation for the chance that in 50 years your front yard will flood. All right? So in a world with no transaction costs, which we'll be getting back to later, it looks as though we solve such problems. But in the real world, we'll all die of suffocation if we need permission to negotiate permission from everybody before we can breathe. And these things are going to come up later, and they turn out to, many of them are connected to each other. All right. So let's start with externalities, which are, I suppose, the biggest problem of market failure, what's called market failure, that the legal system has to deal with. And what is an externality? An externality is a positive or negative cost on somebody else resulting from my action, which for some reason I don't need his permission to impose. And if it's a positive externality, I can't require him to pay for it in order to get it. So when I hire somebody to make automobiles, I'm imposing a cost on those people. They're giving up some of their leisure, but I need their permission, and so I can only do it if I give them a compensation that's worth it. But when I pour sulfur dioxide out of my smokestack, I am imposing a cost on people downwind, but I don't need their permission, so therefore I don't have to pay a cost equal to the value to the cost to them I'm imposing. In what sense is something being an externality just a fact of reality? And the answer is it's partly a fact of reality and partly a fact of the legal system. Because on the one hand, it might mean that there is no practical mechanism by which we can charge the people who are benefited or make the people who are imposing costs pay. For example, my case for breathing, it's hard to see any plausible mechanism by which any production of carbon dioxide, including by us breathing, has to have permission from the people it imposes costs on. But it's also partly a statement about the legal system. If you imagine a legal system in which land isn't private property, planting wheat is an externality, because I plant the wheat, and when the wheat is ready to be harvested, sometime when I'm not around, somebody, one of my neighbors comes by and harvests it and makes bread out of it. So I've provided a positive externality to him. We solve that problem of making land private property. You could imagine, you could take the case of patent law, where in the absence of patent law, I make an invention, other people learn the idea of that invention and do other things with that idea. That's a positive externality, and at least the theory of patent law is that we convert that into property by saying they can only use the idea with my permission. And that raises lots of problems, as we'll see, but it is a case in which whether it is an externality in part depends on the law. Consider radio broadcasts. You could imagine a legal system in which it was illegal to listen to a radio station unless you had paid the broadcaster some annual sum for the right to do so, and in which the broadcasters hired spies to wander around listening for, maybe they would have extra high-frequency beeps you couldn't hear on their broadcast that the spies detector could pick up. Aha, that's a house that's listening to our employer's station. Let's check our list. Nope, he hasn't paid a license fee. Go sue him for, have him arrested for stealing our broadcast. You can imagine that system. And in fact, what? What?
Pretty much how ASCAP works.
I was actually thinking of radio and television in the United Kingdom. It's a government-run system, but you have to, as I understand it, in order to listen to television, you have to pay an annual licensing fee, quite aside from having a television receiver. But yeah, so that you can see, but you can see that some things, it's a whole lot easier to do that with than others. And that in that sense, the existence of externalities is in part a fact of nature, in part a statement about how the legal system treats things. And I think that's a point worth making. And of course, sometimes technology changes those. So that, for example, you could imagine doing radio broadcasts where they're all encrypted, they're all scrambled, and where you have an internet connection which keeps feeding you sort of second by second the unscrambling key in some way such that you can't pass it on to your neighbor who hasn't paid for it. I have to think a little bit more about how you would do the technology, but you could imagine something like that. And of course, cable systems are a substitute for over-the-air broadcast that solves these problems. All right, so what's the problem with externalities? And it's, again, non-economists tend to see it as sort of a moral problem. You know, you're gaining at my expense, or I'm gaining at your expense. From the economist standpoint, the problem is the inefficiency that results. Because, go back to my steel mill. When I'm calculating how to produce steel, I say how much do I have to pay for each hour of steelworkers' time? How much do I have to pay for each ton of iron ore, for each ton of coal? But I ignore the costs on people downwind of me from the sulfur dioxide that's coming out of my smokestack. So I say to myself, should I use high sulfur coal or low sulfur coal? And suppose it turns out that the low sulfur coal is a little more expensive than the high sulfur coal. So it'll cost me per ton of steel an extra dollar if I do it with low sulfur coal. On the other hand, the low sulfur coal will save the people downwind $100, because that's, from their standpoint, the cost of the pollution, which we avoid by or reduce by using low sulfur coal instead of high sulfur coal. All right. So I don't bother buying the low sulfur coal. It makes me a dollar a ton worse off. And the result is that the world is $99 a ton worse off, because I could have saved $100 for somebody else at a cost of a dollar to me. All right. So the first problem with externalities is that people no longer produce in the least cost manner. They produce in the least private cost manner, but they're only considering costs to them and will quite rationally ignore costs that are to other people that don't affect them. The stack scrubber is another example. I can put something on my smokestack which takes a lot of the sulfur dioxide out, but it costs to put it on. I get no benefit by putting it on, so why should I do it? Whereas the right answer is whether I should put it on depends on whether the cost of putting it on is more or less than the savings in reduced pollution. So the first problem is that I produce in the wrong fashion. And the second problem is that I sell at the wrong price. Because I think that the cost to me of steel is $51 a ton, And as long as the price is more than $51 a ton, I'm willing to produce steel and sell it. But the real cost is $150 a ton because of all that pollution. So if I sell you steel that's worth $60 to you, which I'm willing to do, the world is worse off by $90 or so because of the pollution that results. All right? So externalities mean that both you don't produce in the least cost way and you don't produce the optimal quantity. And this is true, incidentally, of positive externalities as well as negative externalities. Suppose we turn it around. Suppose that human beings are different than they are and that they, in fact, love sulfur dioxide. There's nothing they like better than waking up in the morning to that sweet smell of sulfur dioxide in the air. Now where's the inefficiency going to come from? What is the steel mill going to do wrong this time? What? Charging?
Raising the prices.
I'm not sure I understand. What's the steel mill going to do wrong? The steel mill can't control whether you breathe the sulfur dioxide, so they can't charge you for doing that. What decision might the steel mill make wrong now if sulfur dioxide is good? They would install a pollution scrubber only if there was some reason. But what about the situation where high sulfur coal is more expensive? They'd use low sulfur coal if it happened to be cheaper, even though the high sulfur coal would give a free benefit to the people downwind in this unlikely scenario. Furthermore, whatever they're doing, their price, now this may be the point you were making, in this world, is the market price of steel too high or too low?
Too low.
Why is the market price of steel too low?
Is there a positive externality?
So why does that result in the price being too low? When I produce a ton of steel, it takes $100 worth of ordinary inputs, and it produces a $50 benefit for people downwind. So what's the real cost to me of that? What's the real cost to the world of that ton of steel? 50. What?
100 minus 60, right? 40?
It was 60. I thought I said 50. 60, fine. 40, that's right. But what's the price that I'm willing to sell it at?
Didn't you say you were selling it at 100?
I'm selling it at 100 because that's the cost to me. So in that case, the price is too high. Right? The price I'm charging is the cost to me, and if the externality is a benefit, then the cost to me is more than the real social cost. Or consider for a different case the fact that the price that you are charged to attend this university is too high. Why is it too high? Because when you attend this university, you will learn things, and you will tell other people those things, and wisdom will spread through the world, and that's a positive externality, and yet we can't collect on that positive externality, so we have to charge you as if the only benefit was to you. Right? So that's the basic problem. And then the question is, what's the solution? And the sort of obvious solution, the one that everybody except economists, is for the government to say, look, that scrubber is worth putting it on, so we'll make you put it on. Low sulfur coal is more expensive, but the savings in reduced pollution is more than the cost, so we'll require you to use low sulfur coal. And in general, the government will say in each case, we will figure out whether the cost of reducing the pollution is more or less than the benefit. If the cost is less than the benefit, we will command you to do it. That's the simple, full version. Real regulatory agencies don't go into that much detail, but that's sort of the full-scale version. And if that was done perfectly, the firm would indeed solve the first problem. The firm would then produce in the lowest cost manner because they would be required to use pollution control whenever it was cost effective to do so. But what about the second problem? In that world, let's suppose for a moment that what happens in that world is that we do use low sulfur coal and we do use a scrubber. Well, in fact, we don't use a scrubber. Scrubbers turn out to cost more than they're worth. So we use low sulfur coal instead of high sulfur coal. And the result is that each time we produce a ton of steel, we only produce $20 worth of pollution instead of $50 worth of pollution. That's the right way to produce steel. Is it the right price?
No.
I'm still not counting the external cost that I'm still producing. I'm counting the extra cost to me of buying low sulfur coal, of controlling the pollution, but I'm not cost counting the cost of pollution not controlled. So it solves half the problem, but not the other half. There's also a more fundamental problem, and that is that I'm assuming in this that the regulatory agency is trying to produce an efficient outcome. I didn't assume that the firm was, right? I assume the firm is trying to maximize its profits. Not clear what the right theory about the regulatory agency is, but why should you assume it wants to produce efficiency? What's its interest in doing that? And you could certainly imagine alternative explanations, alternative theories of what the regulators do, one of which is that they are regulating in favor of the existing firms, that they are getting payoffs of one sort. Perhaps after they stop being regulators, they will be hired by the firms. And there are reasons in public choice theory which suggests that the political influence of an industry is usually much more effective than that of the consumers who it's selling to, because the industry is a concentrated interest group and the consumers are dispersed interest groups. So there is, in fact, a whole literature which was started by George Stigler and Claire Friedland, I suppose about 50 or 60 years ago, when they proposed that instead of asking what is regulation supposed to do, can we find out what it actually does? So that you have cases where some kind of regulation went in some states, not in others, and you can look and see, is the price of the regulated good lower in the regulated states? Are the profits of the regulated firms lower in the regulated states? You can look at things like this. And what generally came out of that research program was that frequently regulation does not actually achieve the objective it's supposed to do, but it achieves some quite different objective, which frequently is benefiting the regulated industry. Not always, but that's at least a common pattern. Similarly, you could imagine using regulation as a fundraising device. You say, look, the present regulators were appointed by the current party in power, and therefore they will look much more favorably upon your firm's actions if you made campaign donations to the candidates of that party. And in fact, it's a striking fact that many firms in the world as it now exists routinely make donations to both parties. And presumably they are trying to buy favor with both parties. So first problem is that if you do it perfectly, you only control half the problem. Second is that it's not clear there's any incentive to try to solve the problem at all, as opposed to using the power in other ways. And finally, even if they are well-intentioned, it's not clear that the regulators have the information necessary to actually know what pollution control mechanisms are or are not cost-effective. Because that depends on detailed cost information about different ways firms could do things. If that information exists, it exists with the firms, and what's the firm's incentive? All right,
even if they had the ability to gather all the information, wouldn't their cost of gathering the information be higher than the firm's cost? You already had half of that?
You would think it would be more expensive than the firm's cost.
The net efficiency would be worse.
Than if you could get the firm to use it. But so far, we haven't yet gotten to the point where the firm has any incentive to use the information. That comes next. But at this point, they don't. And furthermore, they have an incentive to conceal information from the regulators any time that the information will be used in ways they don't like. So that if the regulators say, we're considering requiring scrubbers, the firm then hands the regulators the study they've done, which absolutely proves that scrubbers cost much more than they're worth in terms of pollution control. And unless the regulators can redo the study somehow, they aren't in a position to know whether it's true or not. So that's a set of problems which make the regulatory solution more popular with the general public than with economists would think about it. And the standard solution up to about 50 years ago or 45 years ago that economists liked was the solution associated with Pigou, economist who originally came up with the argument. And that was what's referred to as an effluent fee or a Pigouvian tax. There are different terms for it, where the idea is we measure the amount of sulfur dioxide coming out of your smokestacks. We do some kind of a study to find out how much damage sulfur dioxide does, which someone's going to have to do if we're going to figure this out at all, and we then send you a bill. The government says, all right, feel free to pollute all you like. It's $100 a ton of sulfur dioxide. Right? And that looks as though it solves most of the problems we've looked at so far. It doesn't solve the problem of the regulator's incentive. You could still imagine the regulators saying, this industry contributed to the right party, so their pollution is harmless, in our opinion. That industry contributed to the wrong party, so we think their pollution is just terrible and we'll charge them a huge amount for it. So you still have that problem. But at least if the regulate, on the other hand, it would be harder to do that industry by industry than firm by firm, in a sense. That is to cheat. And if the regulator at least wants to do the right thing, now all they have to do is to measure the damage, and the firm has an incentive to do everything else. The firm says to themselves, are there any ways of reducing the pollution that cost less than $100 per ton? If there are, do them. It makes money for the stockholders. If they cost more than that, we'll just have to live with the pollution and pay for it. And furthermore, the firm is now paying both the cost of keeping the pollution down and the cost of whatever pollution it produces. So the result is that the price of the good reflects the full cost of producing. So that's basically the argument for Pigouvian taxes, and it certainly looks as though it is a vast improvement on direct regulation. And so far, the only problems we have are, first, you've got to measure the damage, but it's hard to see how you could avoid having to do that whatever you do, and you have to somehow give the regulators an incentive to tell the truth about what the damage and the effluent fee is. And there are then two different mechanisms. I should say this is currently a pretty lively issue in the context of carbon dioxide of global warming. And that, like most others, as I'll be discussing, raises some practical difficulties in going from the economic argument to the policy recommendations. But basic logic of it is the same as in all the rest of the cases. And one approach is this direct effluent fee, and that's that for every ton of sulfur dioxide the firm emits, it pays $100. The alternative version, which is very, very close to the same, though not quite, is a transferable quota. And there the regulator says, look, we've measured last year's sulfur dioxide output. We've decided that we've got to cut it down to 70% of what we produced last year. So every firm gets permission to produce 70% of the sulfur dioxide they produced last year. They get, in effect, you can think of it as like a dollar bill, which says permission to produce one ton of sulfur dioxide. You produced 100 tons last year. You get 70 of these pieces of paper. You produced 60 tons. You get 70%. What 70? Yeah, you get 42 of those pieces of paper, and so forth. All right. So the interesting thing about this is that in terms of the incentives of the firm once the system is working, it is just the same as the effluent fee. Do people see why? I should say these pieces of paper are transferable. I can sell one to you. So suppose you're a firm which finds it very hard to reduce its pollution. Whatever you're doing is such that it would cost you a fortune to cut down from 100 to 90. But you only have 70 permits. What do? You find another firm that's willing to sell some permits, or several firms, and you buy 30 permits. How do you get to buy them? Well, somewhere else there's a firm that was also producing 100 units, but they, by good fortune, have an easy way of cutting it down. They didn't bother because it wasn't worth doing before, but it turns out that the kind of process they're using is one where switching to low sulfur coal is pretty easy. They're close to where the low sulfur coal is mined, so at a not very high price, they can cut down not merely to 70, but all the way down to 40. That means that 30 of their permits are still left. They got 70 permits. If they cut all the way down to 40 tons emitted, they've got 30 extra permits. They sell them to you for a good price. All right. So now there's a market for these permits, which results in various newspaper outcries about how evil it is to sell the right to pollute, but also means the permits have a price. And let us suppose, just for imagination, to simplify the case, that the price turns out to be $100 per permit, per ton. From the standpoint of the firm that wants to produce more than its permits, each extra ton it produces is going to cost it $100, just as it did with the effluent fee. How about the firm that's producing below its limit? How much does each extra ton of pollution that it produces cost it?
It costs it
Costs it what?
The
That's what it costs it to do it. But suppose they say, we're trying to decide if it's worth spending money saving another ton of CO2. And somebody says, well, why would you bother to do that? You've already got all permits for the CO2, for the SO2, sorry, producing. Because we say, if we cut it by another ton, we'll have one more permit free and we'll sell it to those guys for $100. So the interesting thing is that both for those above and those below their limit, the marginal cost is now $100 per ton of sulfur dioxide. Either the cost of buying permits or the cost of using permits that you could otherwise sell. All right, opportunity cost, as economists would say. So either way, you're ending up with the same effect on firms' willingness to put in scrubbers and such as if you had a $100 effluent fee. There are two interesting differences. The first is that in the effluent fee case, what you're setting is the cost. In the permit case, what you're setting is the quantity. One of them is setting a price and one a quantity. So imagine that we have a particular form of pollution where after studying it carefully, we say, look, produce an extra ton of this and it does $100. If you cut it in half, it would still be true that each extra ton did $100. Total would be less, but it would be $100 for each one. Increase it more, maybe it would be $105. In other words, if you imagine a case where the damage done per unit of pollution doesn't depend very much on the amount of pollution, then you have an accurate idea of what the price ought to be, so you use an effluent fee. You don't know whether the effluent fee will cut the amount of pollution in half or have almost no effect on it at all. All right, you see? It's the logic of that. But you don't care. If the result of the effluent fee is your pollution only goes down by 2%, the reason is that reducing it farther than that costs more than it was worth. If the result is that it goes down to 5% of what it was before, great. Obviously, there were lots of easy ways of reducing pollution that people weren't using. On the other hand, consider the case of some pollution where below a certain level it does no damage at all. Lots of things of which this is true. I mean, as you may know, arsenic is a nutrient. Zero arsenic in your diet makes you worse off than very small trace amounts of arsenic in your diet. Large amounts of arsenic in your diet have very unfortunate consequences. And you can imagine lots of things where at low levels of output, marginal cost is zero or very low, then at some level it climbs, and then maybe it gets low again, or maybe it keeps climbing, depending on what it is. Right. So if you imagine, say, that your pollutant kills some kind of plant, once they're all dead, additional pollution does no damage. All right? So in that case, you say, look, we don't know what the price on it should be, but we know what the quantity should be, at least about. We want to keep it down just below the point when it gets really expensive. So in that case, you could use the permit system, whether the permits were given to the firms or just auctioned off by the government, and say, here is the quantity of permits you want. Yeah?
The last line says that the quota, whether it goes to the industry or the government, but either way, the regulatory agencies going to have to monitor the amount that each thing produces.
Correct.
So there is a net cost on the regulatory agencies.
There is clearly a cost to enforcing any of these rules.
Right.
Yes. But my point, though, was that if you do it by transferable quotas, then the... Imagine for a moment a slightly different version of the last one, which is, again, we have permits, but this time the permits all start in the hands of the government. The government auctions them off.
Right.
All right. In that case, the effect is going to be the same, except that instead of a firm starting with 70 permits worth $100 each worth $7,000, they start with zero.
Yeah.
So in that case, again, the auction permit system makes sense if you know about how much pollution you want to put up with, but not what the costs are, and the effluent fee makes sense the other way around. And the difference then is whether the revenue from auctioning the permits is going to the firms that were polluting in the past and got the quota, or whether the revenue is going to the government. Make clear so far?
Right. I'm just saying, like, there's an additional cost.
There is an additional cost
measuring.
And that's going to be true for all of the methods we've been considering so far. And now there are some other problems. Can anybody see a problem that I have not even mentioned, haven't touched on, with the system where what you get this year when we put the load rules into effect is 70% of the amount of pollution you were producing last year? What unfortunate consequence might this have? What?
Shortage of supply.
I'm not sure I understand.
Aren't you supposed to produce
100%
of what you
produced
last year?
No. Yeah, you know, not necessarily 70% less. You may be reducing the pollution per unit produced by putting on smokestack scrubbers, but that's a good thing because you were producing too much before because you weren't including the cost of the pollution. You're a strategic, you're a firm, you're the CEO of a firm, you would like to make as much money for your stockholders as possible, and you are seeing moving through Congress the legislation which will eventually result in setting up this system. What might you want to do?
I'm assuming you're talking about the baseline problem that I want to produce. Assuming that we know it's the year previous,
yes.
I have this incentive to belt out massive amounts of pollution.
That's right. That what I'm going to want to do is, in the year that they're going to base their quotas on, produce lots so that I'll get a big quota. So that's one potential problem, and it's one example of a problem you want to think about in many different contexts. Sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes it's a bad thing, but the fact that people will anticipate the legislation and take action in response. The context in which I thought about that a long time ago is an entirely different issue, but an interesting one, which is how to end slavery. Suppose you're in the U.S. in 1850 or so and you're against slavery. And one possible way of ending slavery is to just free the slaves. And that has advantages and disadvantages. Another possible way is to buy the slaves from the slave owners, which is what more or less the British did in the West Indies. And that's probably a lot cheaper than the Civil War is, but that has advantages in it. Another possibility, and one which people who look at it from a moral standpoint might say, is wait a minute, you don't just free the slaves. You free the slaves and give the slaves tort damage claims against the owners for having held them as slaves for all their life. All right? One advantage of that last one clearly makes the Civil War even more likely because the slave owners aren't going to like that, but one advantage of it is that now slave owners who anticipate this happening have an incentive to treat their slaves better now or maybe even to sell their slaves or free their slaves now in order to avoid the future tort liability. So if you're thinking of the question of changes in legal rules, one of the things you want to think about is what incentives does that give to people who anticipate the change to act in advance of it. And your baseline problem is obviously an example of that issue in this particular case. All right. So let's look at some other examples in the legal system of what's basically the same principle. And I want to start with tort damages, which economists at least tend to see as a version of Pigouvian taxation. And the basic pattern is that I commit a tort against you, I do something which imposes costs on you, and you sue me, and you win, and I have to make you whole. What does make you whole mean? I did something and imposed a $1,000 cost on you. What does make you whole mean? Pay you $1,000. What does that look like? Looks an awful lot like a Pigouvian tax, doesn't it? Because I now have to pay, from my standpoint, a fine equal to the damage done, just like with pollution. There are, however, two interesting differences. One of them is that tort compensates the victim instead of the government collecting a fine. Can you see why that might be a bad thing rather than a good thing? It feels like a good thing. You say, look, you've been hurt, it's only fair that you should get money back. What's the other side of that? Suppose that you're a driver, and suppose you're concerned, you're in a kind of place where traffic isn't very fast, so an accident is very unlikely to kill somebody, but it could do a good deal of body damage to your car. You are in a legal regime where if your car is dented, the odds are quite high that the other party, especially if you didn't do anything obviously wrong, maybe you're moving around a parking lot, say, And you suppose that you're in a parking lot, and suppose the rule is that if you're backing out of your space and somebody runs into you, he's considered to be at fault because he was the one who had the moving vehicle that ran into you. I don't know if that is the rule or not, but let's suppose it is. What's the effect on you when you are pulling out of your space in the parking lot of knowing that if your car is dented, he will have to pay to have it fixed? What? You don't look behind you. At least you have less incentive. You're less careful about looking behind you. So that in general, and this is sort of approaching what we're going to be getting to probably Thursday, and what you've probably already read in the book, that once you realize that most of the things that we're thinking of aren't really unicausal things where only the tortfeasor did something, they usually depend on decisions made by both the tortfeasor and... Let's take a much simpler case. Suppose you're a careful driver, and you correctly believe that you will never be liable for an accident that injures a car. But you also correctly believe that there are some less careful drivers out there, and that every year you drive, there's a significant chance that someone is going to substantially dent your car. What effect, and consider two different legal regimes. One of them is one in which if they dent the car, they've got to pay to have it fixed, and one is one in which they don't. Maybe they have to pay a fine to the state instead, like the Pigouvian tax. How will that affect your decision of what car to buy?
What's the other regime?
In one regime, if they debt your car, they've got to pay to have it fixed. And in the other regime, they don't. Maybe they pay the government, but they don't pay you. Yes?
If they're paying me, I'm going to buy a nicer car because I don't have to absorb any of the cost.
That's right. This was a point, I should say, that was driven home to me a good many years ago when one of my colleagues and his wife came over for dinner and parked in our driveway. And I was careless in pulling my car out. I think maybe I didn't even realize that their car was there, not thinking about it, and put a rather minor dent in their Mercedes. And being an honest person, I offered to pay for the repairs and was somewhat surprised at how much it cost to take a dent out, a not very major dent out of a Mercedes. But you can see that the basic logic here is that even though we wouldn't think of driving an expensive car as imposing an externality on other people, there's a sense in which it is, because given some risk they'll dent you, the more expensive your car in that legal regime, the higher the cost to them. All right. So that's sort of, a fairly nice example. So on the one hand, it feels fairer, but on the other hand, it may have some undesirable incentive effects. And this is a point we'll be coming back to much later. If you think about the general issue of whether you deal with something by a fine or by tort damages, that in some circumstances, the fact that the tort damages compensate the victim turns out to be desirable, and in some situations, it turns out to be undesirable. All right. The other big difference, of course, is that in tort law, prosecution is by the victim and by his agents. That's what you people are going to be in the business of doing, being the agents of victims and of tortfeasors, of course. Whereas in the other, the prosecution is by an employee of the state, by whoever is enforcing the Pigouvian tax. Which means that one way of thinking about tort law is the bounty system. You can say, what's going on with tort law? What's going on with tort law is that we want to impose a cost on people who dent cars. We're hiring people to impose that cost. Who do we hire? We hire the victim. He was there. He knows the car was dented. He's mad at the guy anyway. So he is a sensible person to hire to get the evidence showing that it was your fault that his car got dented. So you can think one way of thinking sort of from one side of it. You can look at tort law as the Pigouvian tax. From a different side of it, you can look at it as private enforcement, as a bounty system. Just like wanted, dead or alive, $100, the posters you see in the Western movies and things. Right? So this suggests then, and this is sort of the first example of something we'll see much more of, that two things in the law that look quite different, pollution control via effluent fees and tort law, are in fact, economically speaking, the same solution to the same problem of externalities in different versions. Let me go on to what I think of as externalities that don't count. And let us imagine that I'm doing something, and what this something does is to make you $10 worse off and her $10 better off. These are external effects, so I ignore them. Is that the right decision? Yes, because
the society only consists of the three of us,
cancel. That's right. So that my private cost is actually equal to the social cost because the other two cancel. And the interesting case of that, the sort of standard economist example of what's called a pecuniary externality. Pecuniary means having to do with money. It comes from the Latin word for cattle because they had, I'm not sure if they actually used cattle as money or just had cattle stamped on the bronze coins. But anyway, pecunia meant money. And pecuniary externality is that when I go into competition with you, that hurts you, but your loss is your customer's gain. It hurts you by driving the price down. Each dollar you lose a customer gains. And in the marginal case, we're considering small changes, it turns out the effect is exactly right and exactly cancels that. I'm not going to prove here. But so I run through my physician case, which is I become the 101st physician. Each of the previous ones was seeing 10 patients a day. Price they can get for their visits drops from $50 to $49 because of my competition. The other physicians are mad at me. They say, what are you doing? Undercutting the market, making all of us poor. Look, all of us together are losing $1,000 a day. $1 per visit, and the 100 of us together, we're seeing 1,000 patients a day. We're losing $1,000 a day because of you. $365,000 a year. What kind of an SOB are you to treat your fellow physicians that way? And I say, yeah, but what about your patients? All of that $365,000 a year is a reduction in cost to the people who are already seeing you. And I'm also producing a small benefit because as a result of driving the price down, people are a little bit more willing to see a doctor. Indeed, if each of you is still seeing 10 patients a day, and I'm also seeing 10 patients a day, then the total demand for doctor services must have gone up by 10 patients a day, because that's the amount being produced. Those extra 10 patients are people to whom it wasn't worth $50, which is why they didn't go before, but to whom it's worth more than $49, so they're getting a little tiny benefit. Getting $49, something worth $49.27 or whatever. And then I say, if you work it, for those who are comfortable with calculus and stuff, if you take it down to the limiting case of very small changes, it's exactly cancels. And in fact, there's a very early English law case, long before economics in this sense existed, where the court found that competition was not a tort. Nonetheless, the gut feeling remains. I was mentioning before class started my interest in World of Warcraft as a place where you can look at economics functioning. And one of the things you see is that pretty clearly that the people who form cartels to try to raise the price in virtual, in World of Warcraft gold, at which you sell gemstones, can't understand why anybody would not want to cooperate, because after all, we're all gaining, aren't we? And of course, we all does not include the players who are buying those things, only the ones who are selling them. And similarly, to take a real-world example, a very, very long time ago, I spent a summer as a congressional intern. And the congressman who I was interning for asked me to look at a proposed bill which would have abolished a large chunk of the farm program. And the Agriculture Department had put out a study of this bill showing that the net effect of abolishing this part of the farm program would be a loss of, I think it was $3 million or so a year, or $3 billion maybe, probably $3 billion. Anyway, and how did they do it? They said, well, look, this is the amount by which government expenditure on the farm program will fall. It'll fall by $7 billion. And farm income will fall by $10 billion. So that's a net loss of $3 billion. What are they leaving out? Anybody know what the purpose of the farm program is? What? Opposite. That the farm program exists to make food more expensive. The farm program historically in the U.S. has consisted of things such as paying farmers not to grow wheat, to keep the soil bank, so to speak, to keep land out of production so as to raise prices, or having a government commitment that if the price drops below a certain price, the government will buy at that price in order to hold the price at that limit. So the function of the program is to hold farm prices up. The reason that the farm income would drop in this case was that if you abolish this part of the farm program, prices would go down. And they were ignoring whatever it was, I think about a $15 billion gain to the consumers, gain to the consumers larger than the loss to the farmers as a result of abolishing. But of course, the Agriculture Department wasn't really interested in the consumers, their constituents in effect were the farmers. Let me go on to look at the general policy uses of externality arguments, because that's an issue that's always current. And that arguments about externalities are commonly used to argue for taxing or banning something, for example, smoking cigarettes. And they say there's a negative externality, so either we should have a tax on buying cigarettes, or alternatively, we should make it illegal for people to smoke in public places or maybe even in private places. And now, much of the argument is wrong in that case because a lot of the cost is not an externality. A lot of the cost is to the smoker himself. He's making the choice. But some of it is external. And some of the cost to him might be external if it results in the government having to pay for medical bills or something. Of course, there might be an external benefit, too. What's the external benefit to my smoking?
Cheaper housing prices
because I die?
Yep.
That's one possibility. I was just going to say that you don't have to pay me off of my Social Security because I die earlier. Okay, right. One of the benefits to motorcycle riders not wearing helmets is a better supply of organs for transplant. And the general, I'll be making the point in a moment, but the general problem with the argument in practice, not in terms of, it's theoretically externality arguments are legitimate arguments. The practical problem is that whoever is making it knows what result he wants. And since he knows what result he wants, he only looks at the externalities that go in that direction. So if you want to ban smoking, you only look at ways in which my smoking hurts other people. If you want to subsidize colleges, which people who teach at colleges would like you to do, you only look at ways in which educating people makes other people better off. If you're worried about population problems, which is where I first got into this back when I was, before really I switched into economics, you look only at the negative externalities for my having another child and not at the positive externalities. And you say there are negative externalities, so we have an overpopulation problem, so we've got to prevent. Got to somehow discourage childbirth. So what are the negative externalities from not having another child? What? But then if I have a second child, that's a positive externality. But in any case, the loneliness to the child is not external to the family, although it may be external to me. That is, there's one problem, which is can we trust parents as agents for their children, which in practice we end up doing. Parents make decisions for their children, but you aren't entirely sure if you should or shouldn't because the parent isn't the same as the child. But putting that aside, how does my family increasing by one result in costs for other families? Put it that way so as to separate out the parent-child issue. Increased demands for what? Why is that a cost? Speaking as a law professor, I don't think an increased demand for places at Santa Clara Law School is a cost. Yeah?
I think it might be having more people to use the resources. The resources are limited because of most demand.
The resources are limited and
more people to compete with you for food, air, or land?
I think we have to distinguish among different ones because air and land are very different things. And the difference is that land is owned and air isn't. So suppose that the result, it isn't that it's renewable, it's a commons, not property. Suppose the result of my having a kid is that the price of an acre of land goes up by 10 cents. That's a cost to everybody who buys an acre of land, but it's a benefit to everybody who sells it, and all the land belongs to somebody. So that's a pecuniary externality. On the other hand, suppose the result of my having a kid is that the air is more polluted. Now, since air is not property, he didn't have to buy the right to use the air, now that's a real negative externality. So people often confuse the two. And if you had insecure property rights so that land wasn't so that when the price of land got up, the result of people stole it more or something, that might be. But in the ordinary case of secure property rights, private property, it's only a pecuniary externality. Whereas with regard to commons, it's a real externality. So how about benefits? I've already implicitly listed one benefit, namely if you own land, my having another kid increases the value, but that's a cost to somebody else. Are there other external benefits to my having another kid? Well, you obviously don't know my kids. I mean, my kids are amazingly creative, productive people. My first son has got this great project for developing a technology for homesteading the oceans with floating rafts with houses on it. And if he does that and succeeds, that means that you and your children will have more places to live. All right, so there's maybe my daughter, I think, may end up as a novelist. And if she's a good novelist, you might end up reading a book you really like worth much more to you than the cost of buying it. That's an external benefit. So that we have production of non-crowdable stuff, of non-property stuff like ideas, which is an external benefit. On the other hand, maybe one of my kids is a real scumbag, and he's going to mug your kid. So, all right, so if you run through it seriously, you see that there are lots of ways in which my having a kid could benefit, lots of ways in which it could injure other people. When I tried to actually do the calculations, and this was 40 years ago nearly, 30-some years ago, I couldn't figure out whether the sum was positive or negative. Yeah?
Well, the fact that you have more people creates more uncertainty itself is a cost.
Why does it create more uncertainty? It might create, after all, sometimes if you think about competitive versus non-competitive markets, the large numbers may give you more certainty because, you know, if one person doesn't produce it, somebody else will.
What if the market is already stable,
but
enough people?
I don't know what enough people means. Look, in the U.S., over the last couple of hundred years, the population has gone up about 30 times. Oddly enough, both the number of workers and the number of jobs have gone up about 30 times. That with the exception of a few years in the 30s, the two numbers have never been apart by more than about 10%, I think, somewhere around that. So that suggests that it isn't that you've got a fixed number of jobs and too many workers give you unemployment, but rather that there's some mechanism which is equilibrating the two, which is how labor markets work. But in any case, so as I say, I'll let you think about in what way might educating your child make other people's children worse off rather than better off. Because the standard argument for public schooling is to say we all benefit when your child is educated, and we might. But I want to claim we might also all lose when your child is educated. So, all right, we're running out of time, so I'll do this last little bit beginning next time and then go on to talk about Coase, which is what next time is mostly about. All right? So, yeah, we're out of time. So, we will...